You're listening to the Zandbergen Report, where wealth strategies and investment wisdom collide with Bart Zandbergen, your distinguished host and certified financial planner.
Welcome to the Zandbergen Report, a showcase for wealth strategies and investment wisdom that's essential for our evolving world. I am your host, Bart Zandbergen, and in studio today we have the all-knowing, the all-powerful Paul, our engineer.
I thought you were talking about your guest. I wasn't ready for that.
How are you today, Paul?
I'm good here.
All right. So now about my guest. He is also all-knowing and all-powerful. Lonnie Side. He is from the law firm of Minyard Morris, one of the most prestigious family law firms in Orange County. Lonnie, you and I have known each other for quite some time now, but could you please share with our audience a little bit about your background, where you came from, how you got here to California, etc.?
Sure. I was born in New York, born and raised, went to college in Boston, went back to New York for law school, practiced in New York for almost 7 years before moving to California. Moved out here in 1991, and I've been practicing in California since then.
Okay. And if there's a lawyer that you don't know, that means they probably aren't worth knowing, I think, is one something you told me once. Is that true?
Oh, I can't imagine I said that.
Not those words. I won't put words in your mouth.
But, yeah, if, you know, our firm is, we're a large firm. You know, family is a very boutique-type practice. Usually it's, or at least historically, it was, you know, yeah, one or two attorneys practicing together. Three would be a lot. We're, I think, 15 at this point, so... you know, mega firms, the civil mega firms, you know, have hundreds of lawyers, but we're analogous, that we're large, you know, for a family law
firm.
So being a partner in my firm, being active in the family law community, it's probably fair to say that if they do or they have done family law, I probably know them.
Okay. So the subject today is really going to be based, of course, on family law, and there's a lot of different things we can talk about. One thing I thought would be of interest is most of our listeners know that in December of last year, there was big tax law changes, Tax Reform Act, and covered estate planning, business planning, capital gains, etc. But one that you and I have talked about over time is the elimination of the deduction of spousal support.
It's a big change.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about what that is, what that means. To what you know, because I know that there's things that are still kind of unrolling, right?
Yeah, see, the TCJA, the Tax Cut and Job Act, is already obviously in effect, but the ramifications to changing the deductibility for spousal support doesn't take effect until January 1st, 2019. So even though the new act is in effect for the year 2018, we don't know what the ramifications are going to be, and what I mean the ramifications, how it plays out financially, until maybe the IRS issues some regs, some regulations, or we have some further guidance. But we know generally what it means and what it's going to, how it's going to affect family law cases.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell a little bit more about at least the generalities of it?
Sure. So under current law, spousal support is deductible by the payor and taxable by the recipient.
Right.
In fact, it's the only thing that has tax ramifications in family law. Even child support is non-deductible by the payor and non-taxable by the recipient.
Mm-hmm.
And all transfers of property have what we call a transferred basis.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no gain or upon the sale. So there's no taxable event upon the transfer of property,
sure,
incident to a divorce. But the one item that there is a tax ramification would be spousal support. And it's a very large deduction in some cases. And for some people, it's a very relevant issue, obviously, with respect to not only financial planning, but tax planning.
Sure.
So under the new law, they have done away with the deductibility of spousal support. Now, the first question I always get at cocktail parties and the like are, well, why? Why are they doing that? And, you know, we can only speculate, but I think I have a fairly educated guess on why they've done that. And everything under the tax system, or our system, has to do with what they call the matching principle, right? So for every income, there's a deduction. For example, if you hire an associate and you pay a salary, that salary is taxable to the person you're paying the wages to, and it's deductible by you. So there's what they call matching.
Sure.
So the government, you know, they don't win or lose on the particular transaction. You get a deduction from the revenue of your business, but they pay the tax on it.
That's the matching.
Matching principle. So the one area where the IRS was losing, and losing big, was on spousal support. And what I mean by that is as follows. Let's say, and I don't want to be or sound sexist, but let's assume, because it's just easier to say he and she as opposed to they. So let's just assume that husband is paying wife spousal support.
Okay.
And husband is a large earner. And he's earning, it doesn't matter. But
high tax bracket.
He's in a higher tax bracket. So when he deducts the spousal support payment to his wife, he's getting a deduction at arguably,
let's say,
45%.
45%.
Yeah. You can talk about combined and blended rates, but let's say 40%.
Right.
If the recipient spouse is at a 15% bracket, she's only paying tax on that 15%.
Yeah.
So there's a 25% spread that the government is losing.
Yeah.
On the amount that they can receive as income versus what is being taken as a deduction. You take that across, 300 million people. Well, not all 300 million people.
Well, half of them.
But half of the adults are. So it's a significant amount of revenue that's being lost by the government. And that's the speculation as to why they've now decided that they're going to not tax support to the recipient and deduct it by the payor.
Out of curiosity, has it always been deductible and taxable, that same formula since the beginning of the family law, or is that something that's changed over time?
Well, I'm not old enough to testify or talk about the beginning of family law. I can tell you
your career, let's say.
Yeah, since my career and under the family code, which came about after the civil code, where it was statutory law specific to family law, yes, it's always been. Spouse support has already been deductible by the payor and taxable to the recipient.
Okay. So talk to me about the term grandfathered. So 2017, 2018, will it affect anybody that gets divorced in those years?
Well, it depends. If you have an order now, if your case is done and your judgment is filed anytime before December 31st, 2018,
okay,
then going forward, those orders are grandfathered in, and the payments will still be taxable by the recipient and deductible by the payor.
Okay. So in what case would that not happen? In other words, by when does the case need to be complete?
Your judgment would need to be filed by December 31st, 2018.
Okay. All right.
So the problems that will happen are people that settle or attempt to settle their case towards the end of the year.
Yeah.
And they sign a judgment, but it doesn't get filed, then they could have problems because they would have based the amount of support on it being a deductible taxable order, which then, if it doesn't get filed until January, will be a substantial problem.
Wow. So are we going to see a sort of run on the bank, if you will? Are you going to be pretty busy for the next
few months? There may be a flood at the end of the year on what we call ex parte applications, emergency applications to the court to get judgments filed if they haven't gotten filed in the ordinary course by the end of the year. So the key now, what we're telling clients and other professionals is be proactive, do it early, don't wait till the end of the year.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Bart, before we move on, there's one I know we mentioned that we don't have a very specific information, but here's the problem.
Yeah.
I'll explain why it's a big question mark at this point.
Yeah.
It's easy to say that the new orders won't be taxable and won't be deductible, but the question, the difficulty for us as attorneys is how to compute what the new amount is.
That's what I was trying to get to.
So similar to the discrepancy between the rates that the IRS were getting on the deduction versus the inclusion, we're going to have that same problem now prospectively in determining what is the non-taxable, non-deductible amount. Is husband going to be able to take what would have been taxable and now tax affected at his rate at 40 or 45% to pay the lower amount? Or is it going to be what the amount would have been tax affected at the lower taxable rate for the recipient's spouse?
Right. So there's no answer to that yet. That's a
right.
Wait and see.
So as an example, if a spousal support payment were going to be $10,000 a month, would husband be able to, or the payor, be able to say, okay, I'm going to deduct 40%, so it'll be $4,000 less, I'm going to pay $6,000? Or is the wife going to say, well, no, I'm only at a 15% rate, so you only get to take $1,500 off, you have to pay me $8,500.
Yeah.
So we don't know what the answer is.
So let's take that concept and let's go to what they call that sunset provision. So 2020. 24 or 26 as the sun set.
Yeah, it's
anyway.
I think it's around 24, 25.
Yeah.
Right?
So I would assume that if should the law sunset, or if it sunsets as scheduled, the payments aren't going to change, right? But they might now be deductible.
Well, I would assume if that's the case, it would then be for new orders after the sunset provision.
Oh, all right. So you have a very busy career ahead of you the next 9 years.
Right.
All right. There's a lot of talk, at least what I've heard from my clients, between a standard divorce, a mediation, and a collaborative. Can you explain to the listeners the difference between that?
Sure. What you're calling a standard divorce is for lack of a better term, the normal situation where both parties hire an attorney and they agree on what they can agree on, what they can't agree, they go to court and they litigate.
Yeah.
That's what I do. Mediation is a process where parties go without attorneys to one person. A lawyer can't represent both sides of an adverse situation, so it can't. They're not representing both parties. They technically don't represent either party. They're what's called a neutral,
mm-hmm.
and they act as sort of like a judge, and they mediate or try and get the parties to come to an agreement without having to litigate those issues, and that's traditional mediation. Collaborative is a fairly new, although people that do it probably would argue with me and say it's really not new, but it's become a lot more popular in the last several years. And what collaborative divorce is, it's a situation where parties agree to agree. What they do is they hire one forensic accountant to deal with valuation issues, one forensic psychologist to deal with custody issues. Each party has an attorney, but they've agreed that they're not going to litigate. They're going to settle a matter. And they utilize that process in order to, using joint experts, to then resolve whatever disputes they have and try and resolve the case.
Yeah.
The only problem with that is, you can agree to agree, but what happens if you don't?
Okay.
So if that's the case, then they scrap everybody. You have to get new forensic accountants, new attorneys, and all bets are off.
Okay. Right. That's a great explanation. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back just a second.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge, with the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days, all with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right, back to Bart and his guest. And I have to ask, we hear it all the time about all the things happening in the, good or bad. Why has this provision not come out? I would think this would affect a lot of high net worth individuals, particularly here in California and Orange County. Why is this such a secret part of the tax provision here?
Well, I didn't think it was a secret.
Certainly has been publicized. I haven't heard anybody talk about this.
I can't talk to what's generally publicized. In my world, it's been extensively
publicized. Huge. Yeah. But I'm with you, Paul. In my world, it's there, but it's not on the top of the list. So I'm not surprised you haven't seen it. All right. So, Lonnie, one of my favorite things to do here on the show is either tell a story or a case study to really give a good example. And I know that you recently had a case published and had to do with one party breaching fiduciary duty and lost several million dollars on some Apple options. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. Fiduciary duties are a very, very important issue these days. and specifically in family law. And sometimes people don't realize the extent to which these duties apply. And I'll give you just an example. Prenups, you know, prenuptial agreements are always a very, very hot topic. And, you know, the pendulum swings on policy. There was a time when, you know, prenups weren't worth the paper they were printed on. The way the law looks at prenuptial agreements now, they're favored. And the law basically says, look, if you've made an agreement, unless there's a reason to invalidate that agreement, if it's invalid for some legal reason, unless it's invalid for some legal reason, you're going to be held to be bound by your agreement. So prenups are actually favored now. They're very favored in the law. And if you contrast a prenuptial agreement with a postnuptial agreement, which is an agreement that spouses sign after they're married to divide certain things, they're radically different animals. Where prenups are presumed to be valid, postnups are presumed to be invalid. And the reason that is because of fiduciary duties. Before parties are married, they are what's called at arm's length. And people are at arm's length, can contract with each other as they see fit.
Okay.
Once you're married, you have a fiduciary duty. That's the highest duty of good faith. That's like the duty that business partners have to each other, where they can't deal, you know, under the table or, you know, outside of what's best for the business. And those same duties, in fact, the family law incorporates the corporation code, and those duties are as applicable in family law. So spouses have the highest duty of good faith towards each other. So when you contract with your spouse, if either one gains any advantage, which presumably would be the case, or why would you be entering into the postnuptial agreement, that agreement's going to be presumed invalid. Now, there are ways to overcome that presumption, but I'm just giving you that by way of background as to how important these fiduciary duties are.
Okay.
In my particular case, and when you said published, just so people know what that means, if you go to trial on an issue, the court will render a decision, and that decision winds up in a judgment. If either of the parties don't like that, or both parties don't like that decision, they can appeal that decision, and you go to the Court of Appeals. Once the Court of Appeals rules on that issue, there is an appellate decision or an opinion that is, you know, provided in writing. That written opinion can then either be published or not published, depending upon the Court of Appeals. Published opinions can be cited as authority, where unpublished opinions give an answer in that case, but nobody else can cite it for authority in another case. So, and because fiduciary duties have become, they've been around forever. Some people say, oh, this is a new thing. It's not a new thing. They've just been, it's been a hot topic in the last several years because of issues that transpire between spouses. In my particular case, I represented the wife, and they were a fairly affluent couple. And towards the end of marriage, in fact, right before separation, husband engaged in very, very, very speculative and aggressive and risky trading, option trading. And as you know, options are the right to buy stock.
Right.
And whereas if you buy a share of stock, you can win or lose money depending, you know, make or lose money depending upon whether that stock goes up or down. But the spread is fairly static, whereas options, you know, you're buying the right to buy shares, which can be much, much, much more speculative and much more risky. When you get into very, very, very sophisticated option trading, and this gentleman was engaging in what they call bull spreads, you basically, the price you pay for an option will vary depending upon how long you have to exercise that option. So clearly, if you have a month to exercise the option, that will not make or lose as much as if it was, you had a week to exercise that option.
I see.
And he was doing daily options.
Wow.
And he lost several million dollars over just a few months trading on these Apple options. And he didn't tell his wife. And that's a bozo no-no.
Yeah.
You can't not disclose it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a duty of care. It was a duty of disclosure issue. And husband thought he did nothing wrong and said, well, if I lost this several million, you know, oh, well, I was trying to make money, so I lost my half, I lost your half, off we go.
Yeah.
And my client took the position that, no, you breached your fiduciary duty to me by not disclosing, because if you told me you were doing this, I would have said I don't agree, and at least you could have then lost your half but not my half. So we went to court. It was a six-day trial solely on the issue of breach of fiduciary duty. We prevailed. The trial court found that my client was correct, that husband had breached his duty, and as a result, he could have, you know, lost his half, but he had no right to lose her half, and they made an award to her for what... basically from the remaining assets to make her whole for what he lost. Husband appealed, went up on appeal. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court, which means we won.
Yeah.
And interestingly, they did not order the case to be published. And we thought it should be published because it was such an important case, because we don't have a lot of published cases on fiduciary duty. And we thought it would have been very important to have this out there for the public to be able to be cited for authority that, you know, you can't do this. This kind of conduct is not acceptable. And my client did not want the case published because of privacy concerns or other issues. So both the appellate counsel and I told her what all of her options were. And she said, well, I don't want to appeal. I don't want to see publication. So we said, okay, you know, that's your choice. We can't do it. And we didn't. And then 2 days or 3 days later, the Court of Appeals got a letter from an organization. It's sort of it's called the American Association of Certified Family Law Specialists. It's a bunch of lawyers that are certified specialists, and they have tremendous involvement in this area. And the ACFLS sent a letter to the Court of Appeals saying, "This, we've read this unpublished opinion. It's of very great importance in the family law community. We're asking for it to be published."
Oh.
So the court said, "You're right," and they ordered it published. So we got it published without being the bad guy to our client.
Yeah.
And so it was published in December of 2017.
Yeah.
So it's been a huge topic of conversation among the family law community for the last, you know, 3 months or so.
Can you clarify were they happily married? Were they married? Or were they separated at the time that he was doing the trading?
You know, it's very interesting you asked that because there was a dispute on when they were separate, when the date of separation was. Uh-huh. We claim that it was done post separation, which I think would have made it worse. Husband claimed they were not yet separated, so it happened during the marriage. As it turned out, the winning or losing the case didn't turn on whether they were separated or not. But technically, according to the decision of the trial court and affirmed on appeal, it was done during marriage before separation, about 5 months before separation. Well, for the 5 months leading up to the separation of the party.
Okay. All right. So at the end of the day, it didn't really matter, but still an issue. Okay, we're running short, so maybe a quick answer on just kind of a business thing question. So you mentioned a date of separation. So in some cases, I know that's, I think, somewhat critical in valuations, right?
Yeah, date of separation can be a very, very, very substantial issue. What the date of separation means is the date when the parties irrevocably determine that the marriage is over. If I had a nickel for every time somebody said, "Am I legally separated?" I'd have, I don't know, lots of nickels. It's a legal standard. It's not, you know, what people think. It's not anything other than a determination of when the marriage is no longer viable. And the ramification that has is to cut off the acquisition of community property. So the best and easiest example is salary. When a person is working, their salary is community property. Once they're separated, their salary becomes separate property. So
okay.
it's the cutoff for the acquisition of community property.
Can if one just decides together, even amicably, hey, I want to be separated, does it require actually a legal document to ascertain that date?
It doesn't require a legal document, but if it's a substantial issue, and, you know, a few years ago when stock options were all the rage,
right,
you know, companies like Qualcomm or Broadcom were issuing these options, and they were worth just, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. That date was critical because a week could mean, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, whether it was separate or community, based upon investing.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a big enough issue, if it's an important enough issue, you can substantiate it in writing, but, you know, you don't need to have filed a document or a pleading in order to be separate.
Okay, interesting. All right, Lonnie, well, it's really been a pleasure having you in studio with me today. I now have the honor of asking you my final thought question. So please share with us your ultimate lesson learned over your tenure as an attorney.
Well, that's tough. Ultimate lesson. I guess the question is whether you're asking me as an attorney or just on behalf of clients. As an attorney, I think it's important to, you know, say what you mean and mean what you say. And I come from a generation where a handshake is more important than, you know, confirming something in writing.
Yeah.
But I think it's a different world these days. The lesson I would give to clients is just be detail oriented. Too many people play fast and loose. In my world, words mean things. And, you know, again, that's consistent with say what you mean and mean what you say. But if it's important, like the date of separation, document it.
Yeah. Well, those are solid words to live by. All right, Lonnie, what's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, well, I guess that depends. I like wine, and I like chocolate, and maybe the perfect
You're
guilty
okay
pleasure
by-
is a little dark chocolate with a glass of red wine.
You're okay by me, Lonnie. All right, Lonnie, thanks again for joining us in the studio today. And for those of you who want to learn more about Lonnie, you can visit him at www.minyardmorris.com. Thanks so much to everyone who has tuned in, and we look forward to seeing you back in the studio next week. Cheers.
Tune in next week for the latest edition of the Zandbergen Report, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Catch up on our recent shows by visiting www.bartzandbergen.com. Interested in being a featured guest on our show or have a question you'd like to hear us answer on the Zandbergen Report? Email podcast@bartzandbergen.com.